This is Ingrid Lindeblad talking with Dr. Charles Anderson at PLU and Ricci Science Center, April 12th, 2000. We are talking about Dr. Mort Vett and his role in academics at PLU.
First, could you just describe when you met Dr. Mort Vett?
Well, I first met him when he came on an interview. He was being considered for the presidency. And at the time, I was quite one of the younger faculty. I'd only been here 3 years. In fact, I would have been in my third year. Mm-hmm. And we were very impressed with him. Mm-hmm. Because he was very obviously a man of sound academic background and understanding. That was his forte, was the academic side of a university as opposed to money raising or simple administration. And it was after efficient operations. He was after upgrading academics so that they could be recognized throughout the country as being of a high quality. And we knew that that hadn't been the case before. So those of us who were very interested in getting a new president and who were in a group that had probably caused a lot of the pressure on the Board of Regents to get a new president, we were very pleased with what could be one of the candidates. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Again, with Dr. Mort Vett, I mean, you stated that he was focused on academic side of the school. How would you describe his philosophy on a liberal arts education? What was his take on that?
Well, he thought it was, of course, the very essence of a university. Mm-hmm. And it had not been that way at PLU. PLU had been primarily a school of education. And so one of the things that he wanted, and a number of us who were new on the faculty wanted, was to get the arts, the College of Arts and Sciences, the Arts and Sciences program, established and recognized as the heart of academic offerings of the school. Mm-hmm. So one of the first things he did was to reorganize the school, the university, into two schools at that time, the School of Professional Studies and the College of it was called the College of Professional Studies and the College of Arts and Sciences. And he gave enough attention and publicity to the liberal arts so that it did cause great concern on the part of the people who were in the School of Education, which had become now part of the College of Professional Studies and was now depicted as being, you know, an important part of the university, but that it was operationally or structurally a small part as opposed to the arts and sciences. Mm-hmm. And they weren't used to this, and there was lots of strife, eventually leading to the resignation and departure of the, I guess you know the title of Dean of Education. He may have just been called Chairman of the Department, I can't remember. And then he had some ardent followers who also left in protest and with very short notice. And so this was a great headache for Mort Vett, and probably I believe it would have been his first year as president. Because they not only left, but they caused a lot of trouble among the alumni, who of course primarily in the field of education at that point, because the school had been primarily a school of education, turning out teachers, and so most of the alumni were in this area. So they were very keenly in touch and sympathetic to the education program.
What do you think influenced Dr. Mort Vett's own philosophy on liberal arts? You know, how do you think he developed that?
Well, it would have gone back a long ways. I believe My recollection is that he taught at St. Olaf for a short time before going back to Harvard, going to Harvard to get his PhD. And then I think he went back to St. Olaf for a few years. And later taught Stevens College in Missouri, well-respected, but sort of unusual college in the Midwest. I believe it was only a two-year college, and it was a women's college. But it had a very high academic standing. And in all these places, St. Olaf, Harvard, Stevens, he had been, you know, keenly interested in having an excellent instructional program in English, his field.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose especially at Harvard, he saw how things should be done and came away very determined to incorporate some of those values in whatever institution was at.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about the core curriculum committee, how that worked?
Well, there actually, as I recall, were two or three before it finally got finalized. But one of them, which might even have started operation in the last year, the Eastfold was here, I can't recall. Either that or the first year Market was here. Anyway, it included a group of us, and probably the most innovative person on the committee was Walter Schnackenberg, who was chair of the history department. And the committee ended up with a plan that would have required, you know, considerable work in a core program in the liberal arts. But in addition, it had a feature that was quite provocative and eventually didn't get adopted. But that was going to call for students being required to take part in academic, well, in extracurricular events like important music concerts, visiting lectureships, any especially valuable program to acquiring a sound academic background would be designated as something that would be important for students and which they would be expected to attend. And so, obviously, there had been great concern about the fact that under the Eastfold system, people were required to go to chapel, and that there was some kind of roll-taking system. We didn't want to perpetuate that kind of thing, but we did realize we'd have to have some way to encourage students to go to these things that we thought were important. So we were going to have a senior year examination, which would be separate from course content, which would be dependent on having been involved in these important extracurricular academic type of events. And we would have asked questions that would have been pertinent enough so that they would scare students into taking part, but obviously not so specific that they would be at all likely to keep anybody from graduating. But maybe if they did, absolutely abysmal. But the idea was mostly that put some pressure on them in advance to attend rather than to really be terribly rigorous at the time that they were facing graduation. And that didn't go. So then, as I recall, when that got rejected, then probably a new committee got assembled and eventually got to be one that was not so inventive as the original one, but which was more practical in terms of blending the needs and the wants of all the different academic units on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And that one persisted for a long time afterwards.
I've seen the records of that in the archives, all the correspondence. It did go for quite a while, if I understand. How involved was Dr. Marfet in all of that? Was he, I saw in the minutes that he attended a few meetings, but not all of them, and I'm just wondering how, did he really have a strong voice in determining the new curriculum, or was he?
Probably behind the scenes, he had quite a lot of influence on many members of the committee. but he was rarely at the meetings.
Mm-hmm.
He was sometimes criticized at faculty meetings for expressing his views when he was chairing the meeting, which is kind of contrary to many expectations person chairing a meeting. I mean, they're supposed to try to seem a bit more neutral on subjects. And he did very well in general, but if he did feel strong about something, like, he wouldn't hesitate to express his views.
Mm-hmm.
So, I would say he had considerable influence, but it wasn't that he took part directly in any committee meetings.
Right.
Dr. Morfett, as we talked about, went to St. Olaf and Harvard, as I understand you did as well. I actually went to St. Olaf for a while too, so I was excited about that. Did he ever talk at all about his educational experience? I mean, I know that you said that he had seen what had gone on at Harvard, but did he express that in trying to apply it at PLU?
Well, I think he said less directly about Harvard probably than he spoke it. He spoke just to like to make the claim that we were the Harvard of the West, which was hardly true at the time. And, you know, even though you can't say that, but it's clearly patently stupid to say that at that time. But he used to speak a great deal about the fact that he had gained so much from knowing some of the key professors in the English department at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I didn't know those people. First of all, he'd been there about 20 years before I had. And secondly, especially in a graduate program, you do well to know the professors in your own department, much less the ones in a different department. So, but nevertheless, they were people I'd heard of as being, you know, very influential in terms of the policies and standing of Harvard. Morfett used to speak quite often about how he admired them, you know, what they were good models to emulate and so forth. Probably not so much, I don't think, I can't recall doing that sort of thing at faculty meetings or that size grouping or talks to the chapel services or anything, but in more the smaller groups he would often talk about his experience. Mm-hmm. In fact, of course, Morfett tended to talk a great deal in small meetings, in good part because he was becoming harder and harder of hearing. And people get hard of hearing, find it much easier to talk themselves than mm-hmm. to listen to other people and then have to respond.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine it's unconscious in many cases. But when that's happening to somebody who, in the first place, has a great deal to say anyway, why, it tends to oftentimes run towards a monologue.
Yeah. And then, let me see. Did Dr. Morfett really bring his faith into shaping how academics should be at PLU, or his philosophy, do you think?
I think so, yes. Yeah. He was very genuinely concerned about PLU being a college or a church. And that, keeping emphasis on courses in religion, on quality chapel services, and on keeping good ties with the churches in the district. So he really worked very hard at it. He spent a lot of time going out to churches, speaking and sometimes giving a sermon, sometimes speaking out of the meetings of the churches. Worked very hard at the annual meetings of the Synod, which were, at that time, always held on the campus, and still frequently are, but not always anymore. But he worked very hard to maintain close ties with, and not just the ELCA, but when Morfett first came, there were still, shortly before the formation of the ELCA, so we had to deal separately with, I think it was called the Augustana Synod. And I guess with maybe the LCA and the ELCA, there were two or three different branches which emerged shortly after that. And then, of course, he was a Missouri Lutheran Church, and he also worked hard to establish ties with them, which was harder to do because they had not previously, from Orpheus time, really had any association with PLU at all. And we still don't formally end them. But there was a time prior to the great change in the operation of the Missouri Lutheran Synod, about 10 years after Marshall was here. Prior to that time, he was establishing good ties, good relationship with them. And then that church took quite a different philosophical orientation and became less cooperative with the ELCA. Which is why we acquired a number of people here who left the Missouri Synod and its academic institutions and things became available and ended up here,
right.
Including Junkins, Provost.
Okay.
Yeah. And I guess we can take that back up too.
Yeah, I think I work up in the archives and I work on the Board of Regents materials, and so you get a lot of that kind of coming in, so I've gotten sort of some hints of it, but you never get the same sort of detail and personal experience, so that's interesting. How do you think that the time period affected academics? I mean, I know there was a lot of controversy with the chapel attendance and with student governance and that sort of thing. How do you think the 60s affected academics?
Well, the Vietnam War caused a lot of concern and action among students, of course, and seemed to energize them and cause them to want to have more say over how the school was operating. I think the chapel matter had already been resolved earlier, very shortly after Martin came. That had been put on a voluntary basis. But, probably 68 or 69, the students became very militant about wanting to make changes in the core curriculum. And they wanted to weaken the foreign language department. That was one of the main things they were determined to do, and which they did accomplish. They wanted to have, basically, I'm sure they wanted the foreign language department to be dropped completely. Instead, it got weakened to where there were several alternatives which permit somebody to totally escape the study foreign languages if they really wanted to. And that kind of got pushed through a meeting of the College of Arts and Sciences faculty jointly with a group of militant students. And it was probably the tensest meeting I've attended.
What do you think motivated the students to want? They just didn't want to fulfill that requirement, or?
I don't know quite why. You know, I really don't recall whether or not we understood at the time that there was any direct connection between it. And I think it was not the Vietnamese War itself. It was more or less the general attitude that students at the time should be given more latitude in what they would be expected to do.
Right.
And so it was just sort of coincidentally taking place at the same time. But I think, too, there were a lot of them who thought, well, the world is getting to where enough people speak English. There's no necessity in us learning a foreign language. We don't want to be required to do it. And of course, it always has been one of the harder things for a few students to study. I mean, it's not an easy task to learn a foreign language.
I guess my last question is just, do you have any, just anything else you'd like to add about Dr. Morfett or about your experience with him? Not even necessarily about academics, but just in general.
Well, he was I thought a really outstanding individual in terms of his abilities and his values. And I really don't think there's been a president at PLU that I've known. I've known him since East Folk time. None of them have really measured up to him in terms of being a person who knew and understood and promoted academics. He was foremost among them. So he was a great real gentleman. He was a fine person. There were people who disagreed with him, and he could be very stubborn in terms of promoting his views. And he thought that there was a limitation on the rights of faculty, but I didn't think they were severe. It was under his presidency that faculty won a faculty constitution, which gave the faculty much more power and authority and much clearer understanding of what rights were than had ever been true here before. And a much better document than you find it practically in the institution around. There are very, I'm sure there are very few schools that have a faculty constitution that compares with ours in terms of its excellence and clarity. And so, you know, he along with that, there were certain features of it which he strongly opposed and which were a few of them actually ended up being rejected at the Board of Regents level. See, what we did was the faculty committee wrote it, and then the whole faculty voted on it to endorse it and went to the Board of Regents, and they reviewed it and reviewed it jointly with some faculty member so that they could gain an understanding of what we wanted. And then there were a few minor changes in it, which probably were prompted by discussions that Mark probably had with the Board of Regents out of earshot of us faculty members, but they were not serious, and I think there were reasonable limitations on it. Basically, a tremendous boon for the faculty. And I thought he was a person who could be admired for his own accomplishments in his discipline and for his academic leadership qualities.
Okay. I guess that's it.
Okay.
Thank you.